It's Wednesday, July 24th, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. A weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my journalism school colleagues, Mike McKean and Monique Luisi. Hi. On our program this week, ESPN doubles down on its no politics policy after a popular radio host speaks out on the air about the president's tweets. Gatehouse makes a run at Gannett. How might a merger between these mega newspaper publishers work? And remembering George Hodgman, a best-selling author near and dear to Mid-Missouri. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our half hour is up, but we're going to start with Robert Mueller's testimony to Congress today. Most of the networks, including NPR and KBIA, went live with their coverage around 7:30 Central Time. And as our audience knows, most likely this program is recorded. It's just about 11:05, 11:10 or so as we're starting to have this conversation. But your early impressions?
Well, so the Judiciary Committee has concluded its first rounds of the hearings, and I watched all of it. And I have to say, the bottom line was pretty simple. Robert Mueller's decision was, I will not give you a single soundbite. Hear the Republicans, the Democrats, or the media, no soundbites. I'll answer yes or no, or with one sentence to questions you ask. He also very often simply said, I'm going to refer to the report for that.
Over
and that's basically
times.
All mm-hmm. he did.
Yeah, that's all he did. And I feel like they keep poking and prodding the bear. They're looking for these soundbites. But I'm kind of getting to the point of, I'm over it. When are we going to move on? Or what is the end game here? But whatever it is, he's not playing into anyone's agenda.
It was pretty clear that the Democrats had a strategy. They had rehearsed that strategy. Mm-hmm. Several members in a row, when it came their time, would take a piece of the obstruction allegations, and they'd go through and ask Mueller, "What your report said this?" Yes. Several times they even asked him to read from his report. He says, "I'll let you do that. I'd be happy for you
again,
to do
avoiding
that.
The soundbite."
But the interesting thing was, there were a couple of instances where members of Congress, I think of Hakeem Jeffries, for example, from New York, took him through and said, "These are the three things that you say in your report would amount to something being obstruction of justice," right? So this happened. Yes, yes, this happened. Yes. Third thing, this happened. Yes. Well, then I would conclude that that was obstruction of justice. And Mueller would say, well, I don't necessarily agree with how you concluded that analysis. So he would go all the way up to the point of offering a conclusion on the results of his report, and he wouldn't do it. And I understand why he wants to do that. And he said from the beginning he wouldn't offer conclusions or go outside the four corners mm-hmm. of the report. And that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
Think he's going to be able, and again, by the time our audience hears this, it will have already happened, but you think he succeeds in doing that in the second half of the testimony?
Yeah, I don't know what will happen with the Intelligence Committee. We'll see if the nature of the questions leads to different responses. I doubt it. I did think it was interesting how up to now, again, mm-hmm. as you said, we recorded this, how the media that we're covering, especially I was watching television, how they responded to it. Almost every news organization in their supers, the lower third graphics mm-hmm. that you see, would just basically said something like, Mueller's testimony, Mueller testifies. Mm-hmm. CNN was the only one, not MSNBC, not Fox, anybody else, but CNN rotated between that and one that said, Mueller, Trump not exonerated. And that was the only instance of anybody attempting at this point during the live testimony. But of course, between rounds, Fox was doing what it always does, which was focusing on what the Republicans were saying and defending Trump. CNN's panel was largely going through, you know, what the Democrats had to do to prove, you know, obstruction. And so it was pretty much what you would expect.
Yeah, so again, I kind of return to the question, what's the end game? What's going to be the consequence of all of this, if any?
I mean, honestly, if you're talking about the end game being that the Democrats are looking for material to put in campaign commercials mm-hmm. against Donald Trump, they're going to have to rely on something other than Robert Mueller.
Yes. In this testimony right. yeah. today. So last week, Ernest and Kathy, Kylie, and I talked at length about President Trump's tweets and how journalists and members of the media in general should respond to them. 10 days after his words were put out there, the discussion is still ongoing, though taking slightly different turns. Listeners to ESPN Radio heard this emotional response on Friday from one of its hosts.
What you're seeing happening around here is about race, and it's been turned into politics. And we only talk about it around here when Steve Kerr Popovich says something. We don't talk about what is happening unless there's some sort of weak, cowardly sports angle that we can run it through, when sports has always been a place where this stuff changes. Man, Muhammad Ali was fighting for this stuff in the 60s. Bill Russell and Jim Brown are really old. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is old. These people who were fighting, the most powerful among us in sports, who are fighting in the real, in the civil rights era for things, atrocities happening to black people that we're still paying for now in a country where this is our greatest sin. What has happened to minorities in this country? They're old and dying. Jim Brown walks with a cane, man. He walks with a cane. He's going to go to the grave without having seen change. He's going to go to the grave with Colin Kaepernick still out of the league. Literally blackballed. Because we're taking this stuff and making it about the flag when it's not about the flag. It's about race. Like burning a cross and saying it's about God. This isn't about the flag. This is deeply offensive to me as somebody whose parents made all the sacrifices to get to this country. Send her back. How are you any more American than her?
So Dan Le Batard's response there, most definitely an emotional one. Hard to argue with, too.
Very difficult to argue with. This isn't the first time someone has been suspended or removed for making a political statement.
Especially at ESPN.
Yes. There's often company policies that to protect a company's brand, whether or not they are allowed to be political or not. It's the risk that people take when they take a stand.
I mean, you know, first of all, basically, here's in a nutshell what he said. This is a quote, so just basically truncated a little bit. If you're not calling it racist, you're complicit. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty hard not to agree with that as a reflection of what Trump and his supporters were saying about, you know, send them back. I mean, that's pretty much hard to argue with. Now, I understand that ESPN has a policy. I understand why ESPN has a policy. I understand why ESPN would want to enforce that policy, especially at a time right now when the country is so divided and race is one of those fissures. But, you know, they are trying to have it both ways.
Yeah. Well, Jemele Hill, when this came up with Jemele Hill, I'm trying to remember, was it this past summer or the summer before? It was almost understandable, though maybe not. And we've had Jemele Hill here on campus, and she's talked to us a little bit about that. But it's a different environment that we're in today, and some of those attitudes have changed a little bit more. A lot of the discussion we had last week centered around those discussions going on in newsrooms right now about whether or not to call the language racist or to let our sources do it, and how that continues to be a debate. How long can ESPN continue to say we're about sports and nothing but sports? That audio clip that I pointed out, it showed that sports has been a cornerstone of political movements for decades.
It has been, but I think what we're not talking about is that there are consequences mm-hmm. for speaking out. And I applaud the people who have taken those risks, but those risks have not been without those consequences. We can look back in history and say, yes, these people made effectual change, but people have been arrested. People have been banned. And then as years go by, we look back and we're like, oh, what they did was the right thing. So yes, it needs to be called out for what it is, but we also have to acknowledge that there will be consequences and that these are bold and brave risk.
Although, you know, I'm not sure in this particular instance or in Jemele Hill's instance what the consequences were. They weren't fired. Now,
no.
ESPN mm-hmm. has fired people who are not well-known talent that bring in ratings and dollars to their network. They have been fired for offenses. Jemele Hill left on reasonably good terms, according to her, and to go to The Atlantic because she didn't want those restrictions placed on her. I don't know what Dan Le Batard is going to do. He's not been fired. He hasn't been punished in any way yet. As far as we know, he didn't show up for part of his show on Monday and then part of his show yesterday, I believe, but he hasn't been punished. Why? Because ESPN wants wants to have it both ways. Mm-hmm. They want the audience not to believe, they want the Trump world not to believe that they're partisan, but they also want to have the benefit of having controversial, colorful personalities saying things that generate headlines. So how do you have it both ways and, quote, have consequences? Mm-hmm. Maybe Labatard is going to leave on his own volition. I doubt he's going to be fired.
Well, and where is he going to get the level of audience he might be able to get through syndication that he gets through ESPN radio and through simulcasts that go on ESPN as well?
I can't imagine that there aren't calculated decisions that are made in these processes. If they're worried about him going independent and taking away a significant audience, it might be worth ESPN's salt to keep him. So I'm sure that there are conversations happening in the background that are the strategic communications part of it that's trying to decide how to move forward.
I mean, there are places that Labatard could go. He could go to SiriusXM. He could go to this relatively new service that his former boss from ESPN, John Skipper, set up that's called, what is it? DAZN, I think is what it's called. And there, you know, he could have some podcasts or other things. Building an audience that's anywhere near the audience he has with ESPN or generating for himself the kind of money he would like to take home, I think it's pretty hard to imagine in the near term where that's coming from. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so meanwhile, we've seen some other very powerful responses. The New York Times asked people to share their go-back stories, received and published more than 16,000 responses that, in a, like I use the word powerful because it's really the only word to describe it. You can take a look at it on our links blog, just this rotation of people's experiences and responses to it.
And it, the irony about the whole thing is that the United States is built on the foundation of if you don't like something, change it, not leave. I mean, we're constantly evolving and trying to change things. And if we try to leave every time we didn't like something, we'd be in constant movement. So it's an interesting and, like you said, situation that has elicited some powerful responses.
I mean, it's just to me that, I mean, go back is like Trump generation's love it or leave it from the Vietnam War, except it has a very explicit racial component added to it. And I just don't know how you can avoid talking about that, and to hear people tell their stories in moving ways, I think is something that the media should try to do. It shouldn't be, and it isn't, just the New York Times saying, tell us what your experiences are, your reactions are. That's a story we should be covering.
Yes.
Okay, so we talked about something like this happening with Donald Trump, and even as he was leaving the White House, Barack Obama, but it never really came to fruition until, well, yesterday, when the Associated Press's Juana Summers, Mike, somebody that you and I know very well, broke a story that Bernie Sanders launched his own media platform. According to Juana Summers' reporting, the idea here is he felt he wasn't getting a fair shake from the media, so he wanted to go out there, reach the populace directly, but do so in a way that was a little bit more nuanced than simply putting social media posts out there.
I don't know a single presidential candidate since I've been alive who did not believe that the media were treating them unfairly or somehow not giving them the platform that they deserved. And so Bernie Sanders isn't any different from anybody else in that regard. But he does have tools available to him, and he has a persona and an entire campaign that was built on talking and getting support from the little guy, so to speak, that does play in really well to doing this live streaming and doing the weekly podcast. So we'll see how effective it is, given the fact that there are 20-some Democratic candidates and not just two, as there were last time Bernie Sanders was running for the Democratic nomination. But if anybody can exploit those tools with the persona that he has, it might be him.
Yeah, I like the gumption. I like the approach. Kennedy did it with television. We have Donald Trump using it with Twitter. We have a history of...
And now we're hearing about Twitch, which is a platform that I haven't been particularly familiar with because I'm not very much into that late teen, early 20 gaming.
Yeah. Right.
That's what Twitch is a platform for video gamers, and basically.
Owned by Facebook, right?
That's another thing. But if people think it's new and somebody has the power to harness the media, then they have a lot of potential.
Okay. Well, so The political situation in Puerto Rico, it's been making headlines across the country as hundreds of thousands of protesters have taken to the streets demanding the resignation of the territory's governor. It's in part due to a massive leak of private messages between Ricardo Rosello and his inner circle. The Center for Investigative Journalism, which is abbreviated CPI when using its Spanish name, published nearly 900 pages of these messages back on July 13th. They contained insulting comments targeting members of the news media, celebrities, including Ricky Martin, San Juan's mayor, and Melissa Mark Viverito. She is the Puerto Rican-born former speaker of the New York City Council. She went on CNN to talk about it.
This is not about me. Obviously, this is an attack on all women, and this is an attack, and basically an attack on the people of Puerto Rico in general. I think what the chats revealed, it was basically the breaking point. There has been, obviously, historically, there has been corruption in different administrations, but what the chat revealed was many things. One, it was about the sexism, misogyny, homophobia. Two, it was about the use of government money and resources to enrich your friends, use of power of the government to go against your opponents. This is really, everything was exposed in that chat, and I think people just had enough.
Her point here is that there's a lot to these text messages, and but more so by reading through them. And if you go to our links blog, the reporting is in Spanish. If you open it in Google Chrome, it will automatically translate into English. But what it really does is it gives the background and the backstory into corruption that has really plagued the island going back far before the landfall of Hurricane Maria.
Here's a problem, you know, for me with this story and the public's consumption of it. There's the sensational part mm-hmm. of the story, which is the comments about politicians and other folks. And then there's the serious digging that the CPI did looking into corruption. And they have voluminous accounts of all the different players close to the governor and various examples of money that was being funneled this way and that. And my guess is that the vast majority of people would not have read that second part of the report had the first part of it, the predicate, the really sexy stuff, mm-hmm. not been out there to generate some buzz in the first place. It's great reporting, but I'm afraid that the posts, the private messages, are really what drove this story to the point where the governor's potentially going to be resigning in the next day or two.
Yeah, it's just a powder keg. And as you said, Amy, it's a lot of information and a lot of history that's culminated into this current situation. And the sexy news on top of it is just a spark that was needed to ignite everything. And I can't help but just wonder, why are people still putting these things in messages? Nothing's private anymore. Well, but that's besides the point.
I will say, though, I mean, and we can relate this back to our own governor from a year ago, right? I mean,
so using, we talked about that last
using
week, too,
private messaging, right? Yeah. We didn't get the contents of those private messages. And that tells you something about, even today, with all the technology and the great investigative reporting we have of leaks, somebody who was a party to had access to those messages from the Puerto Rican governor, supplied them to the center for the investigative center in San Juan, or otherwise we would never have seen those.
So this organization, they've kind of been called the ProPublica of Puerto Rico. They've done some really good work over the 11 years that they've been in existence. Are you surprised we haven't heard from them earlier or any of this stuff going on until these messages came out, that none of their other reporting has made it to you know, the 48 here?
Was it as sexy?
No.
Can I be also cynical and say before Hurricane Maria, how many people even thought of Puerto Rico as part of the United States? You know, it seems to me people just weren't interested. Now, the reason that this organization is doing great work the way you describe it is they've been getting infusions of cash from folks since their great reporting about Hurricane Maria and, you know, all the deaths. I mean, President Trump denied there were more than a handful of deaths until this organization created a database that showed otherwise. So they're doing great work based on uncovering facts that maybe a lot of us in the U.S. should be paying attention to, but we hadn't.
Yes, and also with more recognition of Puerto Rican Americans, you know, it's they are Americans. As you said, a lot of people, there was a survey that came out that a lot of people didn't realize that Puerto Rico is a part in fact of the United States. Yeah. So now that it's getting more attention, it's being treated as such and being included in the conversation.
Okay, so let's talk about the business of journalism for a minute. Consolidation. It's something that we've been seeing like never before in the radio and TV side. In fact, the Nexstar Tribune deal is expected to be finalized any day now. Work in broadcasting, and there's a good chance that it's either Cumulus, iHeartMedia, Sinclair, Tegna, Hearst. If you work in commercial television or radio, they're probably your employers. Well, there might be a mega merger coming to the print side. That, if it goes through, could mean as many as 260 newspapers in this country could be owned by a single company. It's Gatehouse, the owner of the Columbia Daily Tribune and a handful of other mid-Missouri papers, and it's making a run at Gannett, the owner of the USA Today, Arizona Republic, Indianapolis Star, the list goes on. When I first heard this news, I said that if this goes through, journalism will be, well, I'll just say I said a bad word. And at first I thought that it was Gannett that was going after Gatehouse, only to find out it was the other way around. And I think the reason I had that reaction is I've seen what has gone on here in Columbia with the Columbia Daily Tribune under Gatehouse ownership. And really kind of was fearful for what could happen to some of those legacy papers in other parts of the country if Gannett becomes part of Gatehouse.
I'm still worried about it. And I mean, we've talked about how the Columbia Daily Tribune has been hollowed out. And that's one example of what's happened at Gatehouse Papers, especially in smaller markets around the country. Let's not forget, though, that Gannett has been doing a fair amount of
cutting. I mean, Gannett right. has that reputation as well.
Right. I mean, there's only in this climate, well, in any situation, there's only two ways that you turn a profit. You make more money or you cut expenses. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't found a way to make more money systematically. So what you get is cuts. But the question is, where are those cuts going to come from? Are they going to come from the news side or the production side? I mean, there was some talk that this merger would basically be consolidating, you know, production facilities and sales and management. And if that were true, and the journalists who create the stories that matter were not going to be touched, well, okay, it's not good, but it's not bad. I'm not sure I would count on that being the case.
I have faith. I actually bought a subscription to the news, to the newspaper
The Tribune
last week, and I was telling Amy about this because I read an article talking about how social media news and online news, which is great, but you have the constant 24-hour news cycle and there's a lot of speculation going on. So what you have with the newspapers is that deep, in-depth coverage, that local coverage. So maybe if more people similarly had the desire to get that deep local coverage, maybe it'll bring back, but maybe I have my head in the sky. We'll see.
Well, you know, we talked, when it was it almost a year ago mm-hmm. now, when they started making all the cuts there at the Tribune, and basically there was an editorial from the managing editor saying, you got to trust us. Please subscribe, and eventually we'll give you some coverage you deserve. And well, I don't know, we'll see if that happens. I thought it was really fascinating that Ken Doctor, who's one of the media mm-hmm. economists we have on our Links blog, basically said, if you're thinking this is like good news, it's going to be, we're going to create a Netflix for news, or we're going to bring mm-hmm. the New York Times to the local level. No, this is just kicking the can down the road 2 or 3 years, hoping to God that we figure out a way to generate new revenue.
Okay, well, Monique, we are excited that you're here today, among other reasons, because you are a big movie buff as Ernest is. And since he couldn't be here with us today, we have some box office news to talk about, starting with the return of a classic.
You must take your place in the circle of life.
Lion King dominated the box office this week.
It did not disappoint. I will try not to give spoilers. I loved it. No.
Better than the animated?
Ooh. I think I don't want
to
get
This is where
that.
I'm asking her to compare her today to her childhood.
Yeah. I was like 5 years old when that came out. And I have to say one thing. Yeah. Mufasa dies. Okay, they keep that part consistent.
Okay.
And I cried again. But I feel like that it is amazing that the storytelling can just go across many generations, and the technology is so impressive with the live action animation. What I will say is that they made some differences to the story that resonate more with today's environment. And one thing that me and my husband were talking about was that Scar in the animated version was held up as an icon in the LGBTQ community. But there was this issue that they didn't need to make villains appear as if they are a part of the GLBTQ community. So they kind of took away some of that nuance.
Okay.
So that was really interesting that that there's less othering. And also the cast was very diverse, the voice casting. Okay. So it was just very interesting how we've told a great story, but we have come a long way.
Okay, quickly, one other thing again. Because Ernest is usually our Marvel guy, but you may be a bigger Marvel fan even than Ernest is.
I don't know.
Oh, he's big, but I think you're bigger. Like, you're there on the night the movies come out. There's been some news this week, too, especially with Comic-Con going on in San Diego, with what could be coming next in the Marvel universe.
Yes. So Marvel is going to have its first LGBTQ superhero. Tessa Thompson, who's playing Valkyrie, said, you know, she's now the new king of Asgard. And as a king, she needs to find her queen. So it's really exciting that we are showing in a big movie money-making franchise that anyone can be a superhero.
Can I just say, while we're talking about Comic-Con very briefly, Star Trek Picard was also the big news that came out of Comic-Con. And there are going to be Seven of Nine, Data, Deanna Troi, Riker, Picard.
Data, he was the guy with the banana clip, right?
They're all coming back. And
okay.
A lot of people are surprised that show, from the trailer only, uh-huh. Looks like it's going to be really good.
It looks like it's going to be really good. I wonder what Star Wars is going to do about it.
Okay. Slightly sad note before we go. I want to take a moment to remember George Hodgman. The author of the bestseller Beattyville was found dead in his New York City apartment this weekend. Hodgman was 60. Many in our community knew him and his mother, Betty, well before his book was selected as Daniel Boone Regional Library's One Read book a few years back. He's a graduate of the University of Missouri, a friend of our journalism school, and beloved by so many in our community. The tributes here have been touching. You can read several of them from regional newspapers and magazines online, including a piece that one of our own professors emeritus, Steve Weinberg, wrote going back to 2007.
I didn't know George from all the coverage I wish I had, not even so much because he was a great editor, but because it sounded like he was a really compassionate person who still didn't suffer fools gladly. And that's a hard combination to put together in one person.
I think he's going to be remembered fondly. Huh?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the different topics we talked about today on our links blog. You can find that under the talk shows and programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. We're also available wherever it is you find your favorite podcasts, including iTunes and Stitcher. These are all great ways to watch or listen to our program again, to leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're with you for a very special edition of Views of the News.